Rough Trade is giving away a third of the first 3 months of the Rough Trade Club plus new music membership exclusively to 101 Part-Time Jobs listeners. Become a member of Rough Trade Club New Music and you'll receive the Rough Trade Album of the Month straight to your door every month on an exclusive vinyl pressing with bonus material. Club members have received exclusive pressings of albums from Sufjan Stevens, Sprints, The Last Dinner Party, English Teacher, and Over Mono, just to name a few, this past year alone. Sign up using the promo code CLUB101POD and you'll get Rough Trade's Album of the Month, Camera Obscura's Look to the East, Look to the West, for a third of the usual price. By signing up, you'll be getting Rough Trade's exclusive issue of the album on opaque purple in a gatefold sleeve, plus a bonus CD containing 5 demos. Don't want the album of the month but still want all the benefits? Sign up to the standard tier using CLUB101POD and you'll still get the first month free. You'll also get free shipping on all orders, 10% off at the bar and on secondhand vinyl in store, and exclusive access to sold out Rough Trade events. So don't hang around. Head to roughtrade.com/club and sign up with the code CLUB101POD. That's CLUB101POD and claim money off Rough Trade's Album of the Month today. This offer is for UK residents only. Do you play in bands? I did for the longest time, and I wish that I knew that DistroKid was a thing. I don't even think it existed back then. DistroKid makes music distribution fun and easy with unlimited uploads, and artists keep 100% of your royalties and earnings. 1 million+ artists rely on DistroKid to get their music on Spotify, Apple, YouTube, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram, and all the major streaming services. When you get DistroKid, you can see a DistroKid bank and withdraw your earnings. You get notified when you've earned royalties and you can withdraw via the app. And you can even check your streaming stats on Spotify and Apple. Get 30% off your first year on DistroKid by going to distrokid.com/VIP/101pod. 30% off for your first year. That's not bad. We know it's a tough world out there. Why don't you make it easier for yourself? And to get 30% off that free year as an artist, where you get 100% of your royalties and earnings, go to distrokid.com/VIP/101pod. All right, stay with me. I'll be right back after this.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24/7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You're listening to 101 Part-Time Jobs with me, Giles Bidder. I've got Jamie Lenman here, who's to release his new album, King of Clubs, this Friday on Big Scary Monsters. I sort of ignored my own raison d'etre here and kind of only got to Part-Time Jobs at the end of the podcast, but whatever, you know, no rules here. Jamie takes me through all of kind of Ruben's adversities, how they ended, how he started making records on his own, and he's got a wonderful, incredible story and a wonderful way of talking about it. East London's Signature Brew have been brewing music-inspired beers and supporting live music since 2011. You may know them from their collaboration beers brewed with the likes of Mastodon, Idols, Slaves, Mogwai, Enter Shikari, and they've even now done a Jamie Lenman Lenmanade, which came out after this interview was done. As a listener to this podcast, you can get 10% off all their beers by visiting signaturebrew.co.uk and using the code 101podcast at checkout. That's all capital letters for 10% off. All right, this is Jamie Lenman. Enjoy. Cheers. I think you like me better now. Thank you so much for chatting to me. I was at my mum's house the other day, and I was going through photos.
Oh yeah.
And I've got a picture of you and I and the drummer and bassist of Reuben.
Oh yeah.
And I thought, in Milton Keynes from the Pits.
From the what? Because where was
Leisure Centre? It's like a Leisure Centre vibe.
Dude, was it like a sort of a wine bar type affair? Or was it with 100 Reasons?
It was with 100 Reasons and Dave House.
I remember that one. Yes, indeed. Because our other drummer got up and played a song with us. That was great. So you had the four members of Reuben, even though they weren't four members at any one time. Yeah,
you had your old drummer come on then.
If it's the show, I remember. Yeah, I remember a big hall, and I remember like the doors were open on the side, and it was 100 Reasons weird. Yeah, and Mark from the Pilot EP came up and did a number from the Pilot EP, but then Guy, because on the Pilot EP there's this weird like double, we dubbed on some hi hats that were impossible to play, but Guy came up and played the hi hats when Mark was doing the ride and the snare, and we thought this was super cool. And it was, you know, that's my abiding memory of that show. The other show we played in Milton Keynes was the worst show I'd ever played, and I only got through it by transcendentally leaving my own body. So, weren't at that one.
that hi-hat's doing the cymbals afterwards. I feel like that was a technique that was really came into prominence in the early sort of mid-2000s.
Oh, no, yeah, it wasn't. I know what you're talking about. No, we never did that. We were always very frightened that Billy Talent would talk an awful lot about, yeah, doing the cymbals separately. And we nearly did that on Shuffle, and my drummer Dan Cav was not very pleased about it. That's a whole nother level. What we did at the time on the Pilot thing, just we weren't very good at like programming. We didn't know anything about how to get a little trap hi-hat in there because we didn't have any computers or anything. So I just did it. Mark played the drums, and then I did these weird trap hi-hats afterwards myself because we didn't know how to do anything. But yeah.
Drummers have it hard, I feel. Recording for drummers seems like, I'm not a drummer.
Yeah. Drummers have it hard in my bands, let me tell you. Jesus Christ. Yeah. And every studio session, certainly in the band days, was very difficult. Now I employ drummers and they're on the clock. They better get it right first time or they're out on their balls. So it's a little bit easier. But yeah, back in the day, it was very stressful. Yeah.
So what was your life like around them personally? Because I was at an impressionable age then and thinking that everyone on stage was kind of doing this as a living.
Hmm.
What was your home life like around that time?
Well, if it was the 100 Reasons tour, if it was around that, I probably just on the cusp of still living with my parents at age 25. 25? No, I moved out a little bit earlier than that, but it still felt very old. You know, when all my other friends had left home at 18 to go to university, and we would visit them on tour, and I would see them living with what I realize now as a sort of university is sort of a grown-up creche, isn't it? You're not really independent. But it's your first move towards independence. I know now you shouldn't eat toast for every meal and whatever, but they seem so grown up and sophisticated to me, my friends that were living in halls and then living in their own apartments. And I still had to like share a fridge with my mum when I got home from the tours. So that was very hard for me before in the space, just before I finally moved out to my own place at 22, I think it was. And I think a lot of the Reuben songs, I think Some Mothers Do Have Them is specifically about still living at home at 21 and how I'll feel when I finally move out. I felt infantilized because it was not, I know many people live with their parents into their 30s these days, but and I felt like being in a band, because we weren't able to earn any money from it, that was to blame really. And I thought, oh man, maybe if I'd have gone to university, I could have had one of my own very own university halls, flats, wow, with a communal toilet, imagine that. And then you got to fight for an oven ring.
Right, download some MP3s on your LimeWire.
Nice, good call.
But it's fascinating because when you see someone on stage, there is like this respect that you have. And so when you have that kind of dual life.
Yeah, we never felt that respect. Never.
No.
That's the paradox of Reuben, of that band, is that nowadays people talk about it with respect and admiration, you know. But at the time, we just felt like the absolute lowest of the low. We felt rejected from every corner of society. That sounds a bit portentous, but that is how it felt. We felt rejected by, you know, our parents were saying maybe she got a real job, and we were like, yeah, thanks. And all our friends had gone to university and were getting careers, and then we were still mucking about in the kiddies box with our instruments. But then we also felt rejected from the music society because we found it very hard to get in print. There was the big garage band vogue at the time, and we were incredibly unfashionable. We could never get on the right bills. They wouldn't even let us play Reading, for fuck's sake. So we felt rejected by every single corner of society, and we didn't feel any respect or adulation. And even when we were on stage, we had fun on stage, but I never felt any respect. So that's funny.
I was just thinking about what I was going to say, but then the Extra Mile thing must have felt like a big step. But I suppose Extra Mile became the name they are now through Frank Turner, which came years later.
I think you'll find they became the name they are now through Ruben. No, you're right. It's Frank. He's done.
No, but I mean, seriously though, like, everyone does have their own, like, there are people, including myself, where Extra Mile was a name they knew before that. But I mean, to the general societal view of it, you know, that you can, everyone can kind of see.
Sure. Well, it's interesting that you say that, because I'm not privy to that viewpoint. To me, Extra Mile, I don't know if Extra Mile, genuinely, this isn't me trying to downplay them at all because they're my friends. If they're like a big player, I've got no idea about that, because all I know is Charlie and Danny and Anthea, who were my press agents at the time. And I don't really see, I don't know if Extra Mile are a big label. You know, I mean, we chat all the time and they just stayed my buddies. And again, that's why lots of this stuff, you'd think like signing your first record deal would be a momentous moment. But it wasn't, because, you know, we'd floundered for years trying to get one. And then the label we signed to, Extra Mile, was actually just our press agents who had formed a label just so we could get a record deal. So right. they'd had to come into existence just to help us out of the quagmire that we were in. And the same thing with, you know, when we were number one on MTV, you'd think that would be, I always thought when I was a kid, oh, I'm going to be in a band and we're going to have videos on MTV and it's going to be great. But then by the time it happened, because I'd seen all the cogs and nuts, it doesn't just happen like a dream overnight, like you win a competition and you're on MTV. We had to literally post the video ourselves on a VHS cassette to MTV headquarters in Camden. And then they played it on the radio, which is still cool. But because we'd done all the steps in between, it wasn't like this momentous leap. It was just like, yeah, well, that's the next thing that happens. And it took a lot of the mystery out of it, which is fine, because if you go into a particular profession, then you're signing up to have that mystery removed, like I'm doing to you now. Sorry, it was all boring.
Everyone is entitled to their illusion, right? And I think especially now, with when you see numbers, I mean, I was reading the Evening Standard the other day, and I was reading an article about Young Blood, and the first three paragraphs was about how many followers this artist had.
Right, wow.
And this is the way that that's how people see things.
Sure.
I mean, when Ruben got to number one on MTV, was that an anti-climax?
No, that's not. I mean, maybe I've placed that in the wrong sort of setting. To get on MTV, it was still exciting. It was just that you imagine when you're a kid, when you watch, it's funny that the way that pop culture treats being in a band. If you watch like a kid's show or a TV show about becoming a rock star or whatever, we used to watch like Pugwall's Summer, and it was always like you're in a band, you practice in your bedroom for 1 week, and then you play at a disco, and the head of BMG happens to be at the disco. He says, "You're a star," and then before you know it, you've won smash hits, you know, and you're in a studio with a music director and whatever. And it's not like that. But that doesn't mean that when you have gone through all the intermediate steps that no one knows about and done most of it yourself like we did, it's still cool to see yourself on MTV. Christ, I had no idea. In fact, they didn't tell us. I was watching a McCluskey video. No, I wasn't watching a McCluskey video. That came on afterwards. Basically, I wasn't warned for when we were going to come on MTV, and I was just watching it. And then there was a video, and I was like, oh, God. And I I thought, oh, I look fat, or oh, this looks low quality. And yeah, and then when it got to number one, that was exciting. And then they asked us in, and that was exciting. But it what I mean to say is, it wasn't this sort of dream fantasy world. I should have known that the stories that I was being told in pop culture and in movies about kid joins band, becomes famous, were fantasies. But no one says this. No one says that this is a fantasy. And it's the same with, hate to get on my high horse here, but it's the same with the sex industry and with porn. It sounds like I'm taking this to a weird place, but really, trust me, it's connected. You know, kids get a lot of their ideas about sex from porn, and no one says this is a fucking fantasy, man. It's Superman. You know, right. This isn't real life. And so they end up with skewed ideas. And I ended up with skewed ideas from porn when I was a kid, because no one said, this isn't real life, man. And it was the same with the music industry. So when a lot of those illusions were shattered in both music industry and sex, no, it's fine. That was hard to come to terms with. Do you see what I'm saying?
You have to learn it on your own, don't you?
You do.
Not to talk about amateur porn here, but I find it interesting that when you said one of your first instincts, you know, is this low quality? I think that's what attracted so many people, myself included, to Ruben. You know, it was that gave it this punk rock vibe that I was very much attracted to.
Yeah, I mean, that was another sort of millstone that was hung around our necks. You know, we'd say, like, can we get a record deal to this big company? And we couldn't get a record deal, and we were waiting to make our album. And then someone said, well, why don't we just make one ourselves? Let's make a single ourselves, and let's make a video ourselves to show people what we can do. And so we did that. Yeah, and they went well. And then when we'd go back to the record companies, they'd say, well, you've been doing it great on your own. And we'd be like, no, that was like a proof of concept. And then it started to appear, you know, handmade band, self, do-it-yourself band, Ruben. And we're like, oh God, it was never supposed to be this. We just had trouble finding the deal. And yeah, and then record labels would say, well, you don't need any money. Look at you. Yeah, we'll sign you, but you don't need money. Great. I've got this band, Ruben. They do it all themselves. They don't need any help or money. And so that's what happened to us. We sort of dug our own grave.
So how did that end? I mean, if that's not too weird of a topic to talk about these years later, and kind of what kind of place were you in personally?
How did Ruben end?
Yeah.
Oh, man. In absolute ashes. And I was in an incredibly bad place personally. I hated myself, and I hated the guys in the band, and I hated our manager, which is the worst thing, because they were all my good friends, and I was sick of always shouting at them and having them shout at me. It ended in absolute despair, really, really terrible. And, I get a bit confused when people say, oh, my God, it came out of the blue. And you think, listen to our actual songs. One of them was called Suffocation of the Soul. What did you think that was about? And so that's, I mean, if you want to know how it ended, listen to Suffocation of the Soul. That's pretty clear. I was dying. And I narrowly avoided some kind of breakdown. I came very close around the filming of the Deadly Lethal Ninja Assassin video. It sounds weird to say it, but I nearly had a breakdown on that one, just because everything, because we were running our own label by that time. And that was another mistake. And, you know, we tried our best. And again, lots of other people would come up to me after and say, hey, I want to run my own label just like you guys did. You were such an inspiration. And it nearly killed us, nearly bankrupted us, nearly got us into so much trouble with the tax man, because we didn't know what we were doing. And the thought that other people might follow our example was just terrifying. So, yeah, unfortunately, it ended. I mean, it's like what they said. No, I'm not going to go there. We're all alive and we're all friends. Right. So it could have been much worse.
And so how long did it take for you to, again, on a personal level, to get back on your feet and get excited about life again?
Oh, it actually was quite short. It was, well, to get excited about life again, I got excited about life again straight away, because the band was a huge thing that was dragging me down and making me miserable. And everyone, you know, all my close friends and colleagues, you know, noticed the change in me. And it was a long thing that had a slow corrosive effect over maybe 5 or 6 years. So as soon as the band finished, I felt absolutely brilliant. I felt like a new man. I felt like I'd only just been born. It was amazing. And I had a year, a really wonderful year, where I didn't make any music. and I was just free to be myself, and I did things that other people did, and I went and visited my friends that I hadn't seen for years because I'd always been on tour. I got my life back. It was really quite liberating.
And was it strange to not write songs, though? Because I feel like there is something about the soul. When you're writing songs, there is this kind of deep inner purpose.
Well, it sort of came back, and they would always, I think there's a song, I only reference my own songs. I'm not trying to get like PRS points or anything for lyrics, just because a lot of the stuff I say, I'm about to say it and I realize, oh, it's a lyric from whatever song. So I feel like I need to point it out. There is a song, Agony Agatha, about how the words were always going around in my head and they wouldn't go away until they finished. That really, it's like I'd taken a pill that disappeared for about a year. I didn't hear any of those voices and it was great. And I could get some fucking sleep. And then about a year, they started to come back. The song started to come back. And so did the bad feeling. It's a very weird. I then, you know, having been on the verge and the threat of a depressive period at the end of the band, well, I was definitely in. I then sunk into an even lower low when I started making Muscle Memory. It's a bizarre relationship with music. I had this year when I was fine, and then oddly, as soon as I started to sort of make music again and start jamming out with Dan Cav, who drummed on Muscle Memory and Devolver and Shuffle, I started feeling really bad again, even though I was enjoying making the music. And I don't know if they were related, but they probably were. It was a weird thing. And by the time Muscle Memory came out, I was fine. But maybe it was the delayed reaction from the band. I don't know. The way to talk about it now, it does sound like that sort of free year I got. Maybe I was even in shock. and I had this year of feeling great. And then all of a sudden, I had another crash. It's very weird. I can't really explain it.
The saddest lyrics are often the ones that are just, you know, the most poignant and the ones that touch people the most.
Those are the most interesting, truthful experiences. I sort of realized quite early on that you can't make good art without experiencing pain, and nothing that's ever been worth doing has ever been easy. You know, the band taught me that, and certainly all of the music, it's slightly different drawing cartoons, the other side of my life. There's not much painful about drawing cartoons, although it is a struggle to find your own voice in that area as well. But with the music, certainly all of the albums I've made have involved putting myself in difficult spaces and have involved struggle and hurt at some point. And I think that's when the best art comes out. Yeah, so I don't mind going there.
On the art, As an illustrator, when did that start for you, and when did you start getting commissions?
Well, I didn't get commissions until very late. I was drawing before I picked up a guitar, so I was always drawing and drawing my own little cartoon strips. So I was very taken with the syndicated three-panel strips like Peanuts and Garfield, so I always wanted to do that. And I got a commission. It wasn't really a commission because it wasn't paid, but when we started playing gigs and the magazines would come to the shows to review them, I managed to corner Darren, the editor of Rock Sound, and I knew they didn't have a cartoon. And I loved Pandora, Ray Zell's Pandora in Kerrang, and I wanted to do my own one.
Yeah, I love that.
And so I said to him, you need a cartoon like Pandora. And he said, well, I can't afford it. And I sort of stupidly, but no, it was a good move. I said, look, I'll do you one. You'd have to pay me. And he said, great. So for a couple of years, I did a strip called Rockbot for Rock Sound magazine, which no one ever read. But it was a great experience for me, even if it was unpaid, which is fair enough, to learn about publishing and about what you can and can't do in the public sphere and to grow my craft. I think the first money commission I ever got was in Doctor Who magazine, which happened after I got fired. How'd you get fired from an unpaid position? But I got fired from Rock Sound. and then I hustled Doctor Who Mag because I was looking for another cartoon to do because I got the taste for it. And I hustled Doctor Who magazine for quite a while. And they're the first people that paid me for my art. Imagine that. Wow. I just went to them. I was incredibly naive. I think I even called the editor from a payphone. Maybe I didn't even have my own phone. And again, you know, I sent stuff in the post. We were still sending stuff in the post. I just sort of badgered him a bit. And he said things that, because he was a very mercurial guy, the editor at the time. And even now, I don't really understand what he's saying. And he said lots of stuff that I thought was a rejection. And then when I got hold of him, you know, a year and a half later with some new bits, he said, I was waiting for more contributions. Why didn't you send any more stuff? And I said, well, I thought he said, no, you didn't like it. He said, no, that's just me saying, like, make it a bit brighter or draw a mustache on him. So it was quite, it was very personal. It was a personal thing between myself and the editor, which I found is how it goes down. You form a personal link with them. These editors, again, they're not just faceless companies that you send in and they go, yes, you're a star. It takes a long time of getting to know someone before you find a space. And I'm still working for Doctor Who magazine today. They're my longest professional relationship. I've just been emailing them this morning about what we're going to do for the next issue. And I'm very great. Pleased to have that connection.
And that's something I talk about on this podcast a lot. And my guests speak about is this level, just this serious level of self-motivation that is required for art.
Yes, it's huge and it's very hard to find it some days, like today. In fact, all this week, I've just rolled out of bed and asked myself, what is this for? You know, and of course, it's tough with the lockdown as well. And, for performers, we've had, it feels like having a leg cut off or an arm cut off. Very weird.
Presumably not much has changed for your illustration world, though, in the last 4 months. Has that gone up?
No, well, it's weird, actually. As of a couple of years ago, as of really when I started working with BSM, and I don't, again, I'm not sure if it's cause and effect, but it might be since sort of Devolver time, the illustration work has taken a huge dip. I was doing a lot of illustration stuff around muscle memory and after that, before Devolver. Since sort of Devolver times, last couple of years, very low levels of illustration work, which of course has been fine because I've been touring and making records, and that's great. And then when lockdown happened, I did think, oh, shit, I could do some illustration work now. And a couple of bits did come along, which is great. But now they've sort of gone away as well. So now I don't have either. And I'm just sort of relying on, you know, if you're a freelance artist and you work for yourself, you work out how to use your money wisely. And I'm just hoping I've been wise enough to weather the storm. I made two albums in 2019. I made Shuffle at the start and I made King of Clubs at the end. And in between, I did two tours and a couple of supports and all over the place and festivals. It was crazy. And making all the videos myself and making all the promotional material. 2019 was a crazy, crazy year for the music. So that was probably the biggest imbalance between illustration and music that I've had. And I only really did my little monthly commission for Doctor Who Mag at that point. So yeah, it was mostly music last year.
And that was 6 years on from Muscle Memory. Just tracking back to that time, 2013, I remember seeing it and being like, oh great, this guy from Ruben, you know, coming back. At that point, I mean, unwittingly, and I'm sure you won't feel the same, but I felt that Ruben had developed this kind of cult status, you know, for a subculture of mostly British people. Yeah. So where were you making that album and then, you know, then releasing it?
I got to tell you that the sort of cult status of Ruben, actually it worked against me because I felt like I had this sort of legend to live up to, and it made me very wary and cautious about making any new music, because every day there'd be some, you know, fresh accolade heaped upon me. And the longer people waited for new music, the higher their expectations got, which is why I didn't announce the album. I just put it out and was like, here you go, deal with it. Because I didn't want, I knew as soon as I said, oh, I'm going to be making new music, people would go, oh, and they'd all form their own ideas about what it was going to be and they'd all be wrong. So I just sort of put it out there. Yeah, it made a big difference to how I approached it. I sort of wanted to just put it out as a pay what you want thing. I didn't imagine putting it out with a label or anything. And then Extra Mile got involved in it and we did a good job on it. But it was very weird. I was very trepidatious and I was very anxious about living up to this impossible ghost that people had created out of my old band. I find that a bit easier these days, but you have to remember that around Muscle Memory time, not only was I coming out of let's call it a depression for want of a better word. I was also very unwell physically. I gained a lot of weight and I was very shy and hesitant, and I think that comes through in the supporting materials and the shows that we did. I was very unsure of myself. So it was a difficult time for me, I was quite fragile emotionally, and it was really weird. And I got to say that, yeah, that cult of Ruben didn't help because it felt like I had to live up to my own self, if that sounds weird. And these days I have a much easier time with it.
Rock journalism is always going to talk about the things that happened before. And there's always going to be this, you know, it's cruel, isn't it, really? This comparative nature of it.
Well, it makes sense, but it just sort of gets in. I can see why people do it, and I wouldn't be like, how dare you? But it does have knock-on effects for the artists themselves, yeah. If you're always going to be, you're always going to be compared to what people think your best thing is. Luckily for me, everyone disagrees about what their best thing is, so fine.
And then it was 4 years before Devolver.
Mm.
How so? Did that get better over those years? Did you became more sure of yourself?
Yeah, I mean, doing Muscle Memory showed me, and touring Muscle Memory showed me what I was capable of and what I wasn't capable of. I learned a lot about touring Muscle Memory and having a larger band and being, being a band leader instead of in a band. There's a difference, you know, being in total control. And not having to answer to anyone, work all that stuff out. Yeah, I mean, now you say 4 years, God, it was a big gap, wasn't it? But again, do you know what? A lot of that was because after Muscle Memory, I learned from the mistakes I'd made. And I said to myself, right, if we're going to do this, let's do it properly. And let's get a management team, because I didn't have any management on Muscle Memory. And let's get, a proper press team. Let's get all things. Oh, and I had a press team, but I needed a whole bunch. I needed a whole society around me. It sounds weird. Whereas Muscle Memory, things were a little bit less organized. I wanted to do it properly. And it just took a long time to assemble that team.
One of the things that people in art, the artists struggle with, is knowing where and how to delegate.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's exactly right. I thought on Muscle Memory, I didn't need a manager. Hey, I can make all the decisions myself. And that was not true. So the first thing I did when I collected myself up to do something else was I started with the management. And then it went from there. And then they were so helpful in every aspect, not only putting together the team, but also putting together the record. You know, they told me which songs they thought really worked as a bunch, because I just sent them everything I had and said, which ones should I record? And they picked, you know, 12. And that's what we did. And they had a very clear vision of what they wanted for me. And it didn't always exactly overlap with mine, but it overlapped enough to make sense and to work. So yeah, it worked out really. And I think you can see in the results, if you compare what happened with Muscle Memory to what happened with Devolver, you can very easily see the difference in those two approaches and what worked. And I'm very happy with what happened with Devolver and since.
It must have been like a real vote of confidence as well, you know, to have that manager, to have that support, to take yourself seriously.
Yeah, it was great. Yeah, that's what they're really good at. Matthew and Simon, my managers, they take me seriously. And after years of, I think that's the thing I need the most, is just to be taken seriously. Like I said, after years in that band of getting no respect and laughed off the stage, I mean, that's what it felt like. And no one would give us any money or time to do anything. Felt like no one took us seriously. To be taken seriously is maybe the thing I crave the most. And so, yeah, that's why they're good. Maybe they see that in me. Maybe they're just humoring me. God, this guy needs to feel like we care what he says. But yeah, I do. However they do it, I do feel like they care what I say, and that's very important.
How old are you now, if I can ask?
I'm 37. Well, I couldn't just say man. Well, you could have said Dennis. I'm so sorry. Every time I remember my age, it's the age of Dennis, the old woman from Holy Grail. Old woman, man. I'm not old. I'm 37, so I'm 37. Sorry.
I mean, there must be something cool about growing up and being like, yeah, this is me. I don't have to worry about comparing myself to another 25-year-old.
Yeah, I really like being 37. I always had a sneaky suspicion that I would enjoy growing old. And in fact, you know, I can't wait to be 90 and 100. I'm looking forward to it. Yeah, I like getting older. I think I'm getting better.
King of Clubs is obviously very exciting. New album coming out this month when this podcast goes out.
Yeah.
What were the first moments when you started planning this record?
Well, as I've gone on record to say, it sort of evolved accidentally. It was an accidental album. I didn't mean to make it. It was the label was saying, oh, we should do it because we all thought we were going to be touring in the Easter this year. Obviously, it didn't happen, but that was the plan. And so around the end of 2019, they were saying, we want a single in the spring. We want an Easter single. And I was like, yeah, okay, can do. And I had a couple of tracks that would work for that. So that was the idea, that I was going to go in the studio in December and have something ready for the Easter period. And then I thought, well, I don't want to just do another single, because when we did Devolver, we sort of followed it up with Long Gone in Easter. And I didn't want to just repeat that pattern and have it like, oh, every time he does an album, he does a little single in the spring. So I thought maybe I'd do like an EP. Maybe I'd stretch it out to four tracks and we can put that on a little 7-inch, and that would be cool. And then by the time I got to the studio, I had even more stuff, and I was sort of caught between two places, because I didn't want to, like I say, I didn't want to do just another one track, two track single to repeat the Long Gone thing, to buffer an album with a single. But equally, I definitely didn't want to do another album so soon after Shuffle, because Shuffle was a big meal and I think people still need time to digest it. And I don't know whether, I hope, I got the idea that people took it seriously as my third album. I know a lot of fuss was made about the fact that it was technically a covers record, but you know, as far as I'm concerned, it's my third proper full-length album. So the last thing I wanted to do was encroach upon everyone's headspace of Shuffle with another record straight after, another full-length album. So I had to sort of find somewhere between single and album, and I just kept getting more material, and I had to sort of stop myself short, because, you know, we ended up with 7 tracks, mini album, which really is just on the barrier of how much info I wanted to give people to digest in another release. So it just kept growing and growing, and I had to pull up the reins to stop myself even from making another full length. And like I've said, I'm not sure I would have wanted to make a full length of King of Clubs, because it's quite nasty and it's quite a dark place to be. And I'd actually wanted to make a mini album. I like the format of the mini album for quite a while. So I thought, yeah, if we don't have an EP, I would have been happy with an EP, but I thought this could be even better if I just put in some light and shade. The tracks for the EP were going to be the sort of more immediate, short, sharp shocks. And I thought, that's fine, but if we could just add a bit of depth, then it could be really special. And that's what happened. Does that make any kind of sense?
Yeah, it does. When you say, you know, the lighter and the darker moments, it really highlights to me, no pun intended, highlights to me that, you know, the smorgasbord of, you know, and you use the word appetite. I think that's such a great word to use for your records, because it is really a buffet of styles, isn't it? And I wonder, you know, a lot of records like that kind of, you know, that kind of style, that kind of format lends itself to concept albums.
I suppose, I mean, Shuffle is definitely a concept album, not one that tells a story all the way through, but it had a framework, and it had, you know, this is what we're going to say with this. So yeah, you could call that a concept album. I mean, it's a difficult thing. You can say a record has a theme without it being a concept album. So King of Clubs definitely has an ongoing theme, which is about like uncomfortable emotions and lots of negative thoughts. And we very purposely tried to make the sound dirty and dark, but I don't think that makes it a concept album. Muscle Memory, maybe that was a concept album, because I knew going in, I wanted to have one half heavy and one half soft, but then they don't really tell like a narrative. In my mind, a concept album usually sort of tells a story. It's like maybe like a rock opera, but maybe that's a little too narrow. Most of the time, yeah. I mean, I got lots of ideas for albums that aren't necessarily concept albums. I think Shuffle is possibly the only concept album I've made, but that's not to say there might not be others.
And King of Clubs as an album title, it's quite an uncomfortable title as well, because there is this kind of magnitude of it, you know?
Yeah, well, I thought it had a lot of layers of humor to it. There was, it actually came, one of the tracks was supposed to be called King Cruel or King of Cruelty. And then I'd done some artwork with a severed hand that had a club tattoo on the back, and that image really, I really enjoyed it. And then I thought, well, why not I just call it King of Clubs? And then I could have like a card, because I wanted to do a playing card as myself as a playing card, and it all sort of tied in. Mm. But then I also thought to say that you were the King of Clubs in a live sense, because, you know, I'm a club guy. I'm always on the club circuit, right? To say that you were the King of the Toilet Circuit. Yeah. I thought that was a nice air of self-deprecation there to stop it getting too grandiose, even though I bought myself a fucking crown. But, you know,
The crown?
I bought myself a crown.
Wow.
For the photo shoot.
Expensive crown?
Yeah, it's just a cheap piece of shit. But it, okay. You know,
it's not exciting.
It's not exciting. But I, you know, I made it work for the photos. But yeah, I don't know if anyone's picked up on that, the King of Clubs. It's a self-deprecating joke, again, to sort of undercut the pomposity of proclaiming yourself the king of anything. And do you know what? It's not even, I'm not the King of Clubs. That's not the King of Clubs of the title. The King of Clubs is the horrible wraith on the cover. It's King of Clubs is a representation of negative emotions. So I hope that's not me. But God, maybe sometimes it is. Oh, there's levels.
It's a striking cover. I mean, quite religious themes.
Yeah, I mean, I read a lot of Mike Mignola. I don't know if you know who Mike Mignola is. Created Hellboy.
Oh, yeah.
And his comics, you know, I've got a library full of his graphic novels, and his art has been a great influence on me. And they're full of sort of medieval representations of spiritualism and symbolism. And actually, I'm a sort of amateur medieval scholar anyway. So I'm fascinated with them. I'm fascinated with iconography as a start. You can see from Shuffle the way I set myself the task of, as a designer, boiling down each of the tracks into a single icon. And so that iconography was always fascinating me. And then the club I have, I mean, you probably will believe me when I say I have several medieval packs of cards that I, because I love... I love the way a same. Everyone knows what the King of Hearts looks like, or the four packs, or the four suits of a deck of cards. But the variations that you can have within how those are rendered as simple everyday objects that everyone takes for granted: the spade, the heart, the club, the lightning bolt. What's the other one? The diamond. I love to see the variations in packs of cards. So I got a little bit obsessed with packs of cards and medieval iconography, and so the weird sort of elongated club, which is quite frightening, really. And then if there was a King of Clubs, what would it actually look like? I just went down this whole rabbit hole of iconography. And yeah, I suppose a bit of it is slightly religious. The club looks a little bit like a crucifix, doesn't it? That's no mistake. Mm. But a scary crucifix. Well, crucifixes are scary anyway. So yeah, right. that is in there. You're quite right.
Are you collecting old packs of cards from back yonder?
Yeah, I got a very weird collection of packs of cards. Yeah, I'm looking at one of them now.
Where'd you find them?
Medieval fairs. You know, I'm very middle-aged. When people were allowed outside, I used to go to an awful lot of medieval reenactments and medieval fairs. I spend a lot of my time reading about the medieval Europe and collecting bizarre things. I got a bone cup. I got a horn spoon.
I used to live in Wapping, and there was a group that came up once a week, once a month, they would be dressed up, all dressed up,
yeah,
going to some kind of, you know, reenactment. And at first, I thought it was silly, probably because I was scared of it and I didn't understand it. And then I thought about it and I was like, no, that's actually really cool.
It's really cool. I thought it was silly for a long time when I was a kid. I think when you're a kid, you are always pushing for the new, and anything from the old days, you think to yourself, well, that's done. They've done that. Why are we even talking about it? It's done. It's been done. But then as you get older, you realize that the ramifications of things that happened in the past have on the present. I went to a reenactment of the Battle of Hastings last year, 1066, at the place at battle where it was originally fought. And it was quite overwhelming, because obviously they didn't have the same numbers, but there was a lot of Saxons and a lot of Normans. And I thought to myself, and there was a commentator as well, and there was like, and now Harold gets the arrow in his eye and he's lost the battle. And I thought, oh, every year Harold does this. Every year Harold gets the arrow in the eye and Norman wins the country. Why not just 1 year? Can Harold not win? Wouldn't that be lovely if the Saxons won just 1 year?
You're trying to rewrite history and be a journalist, Jamie.
Well, maybe, yeah. But then I thought, if that did happen, what would... Because every year we reenact it and it just strengthens the facts. If you made Harold win, would that have the opposite effect? Would it reverberate backwards through time and turn out that we're all still Saxons? Well, then I went into another weird rabbit hole. Sorry.
Love it. Love it. Jamie, this has been such a fascinating chat. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
We didn't even really talk too much about the menial jobs.
No, I was wondering when that was going to come up. Wow.
Well, let's end on it. Why not? We got our space here.
Yeah.
Where did that start? What was the first one that really had an impact on your life?
Oh, well, my first job was working at Littlewoods in Camberley. It was terrible. Just behind the till, like selling nylon dresses day in and day out to old ladies. That was terrible.
Nylon dresses?
Yeah, like horrible synthetic fiber clothes Littlewoods used to sell, like really nasty stuff. But then they'd put me on, they made lots of mistakes. They'd put me on greeter, which is where you literally would just take a member of staff and stand them by the door and have them say hello to people when you come in. But I'd be like, hi, it's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. Welcome to Littlewoods. And I got stopped from doing that a lot of the time. I used to pretend that the top half of my arms didn't work. I served someone with two false hands from a dummy once. Quite often, one of my griffs was that I would steal the hand off one of the shop dummies and use it as my own hand. And just for fun, and people would get cross with me and I wouldn't do their bags properly. And I never intended for anyone to assume that I was an amputee, that this was a replacement for my natural hand. I just always thought everyone was in on the gag. And one time I went way too far. I got two hands from a mannequin. So neither of my hands were functional. They were just, you know, worse than prostheses, because prostheses these days are pretty good and flexible. These were just dead stone hands. And I did this guy's entire shopping with these hands, just ruining it. And like I say, it was never my intention to present to someone the fact that these were my real hands, that I was missing my natural hands and I had these instead. But I noticed after a while that he was not getting cross with me, this guy, because I expected him to go, what are you doing? You know, and tell me to snap out of it any second. And after about an hour of putting the stuff in a bag, he said, you're very brave. And I just felt so bad because when you're a kid, you don't think about, you know, there are people that don't have fucking hands and they work in a shop. And this guy was so excellent. What a guy. And, you know, I grew up a lot that day. But like I say, I was just mucking around. I wasn't trying to impersonate an amputee, but he took it that I was an amputee and I felt terrible. But I got fired from that job. I did lots of bad stuff. If you get models for modeling a shirt, sometimes it's just the top of a mannequin. I had lots of fun with the mannequins. If they're modeling pants, I don't know if you know this, but we used to have just groins. It was just a groin to model just the pants, right?
Right.
So if you're modeling a watch, they have just an arm. I had this groin and it was black and it was just this black ass. And I just used to put the black ass on the table. And someone even chucked a tip in there because it was hollow from the top. They had such a fun time. I got fired from that job.
When you got fired, was that a scary moment? Did you feel like you had to make a change in your life?
No, I had made one too many errors and I was getting bored of the job. It was so badly paid. It was like, I think I got like £3 an hour. But to me, because I did 4 hours a week, wow, this is a big job. That meant I could afford an album a week. Imagine that, an album a week when you're fucking 16 or whatever. So to me, it was like an incredibly luxurious, well-paid job. It was just time for me to leave, and I'd caused some kind of upset or whatever, or maybe I'd tried to serve someone whilst doing a handstand or whatever. There was an old lady who wrote to Littlewoods to say that she was so terrified she'd never enter the store again while I was still working, which I was actually quite upset about because I was never nasty to anyone. I can't think what I did to upset this old lady so much. People just found me very offensive And we could do a whole week on this. I got stories. I've had other jobs that I got fired from. But yeah, that was my first job. It was a bad fit. I think that was the only job that I got outright sacked from. Although, like I say, I got sacked from doing the cartoon at Rock Sound. No, I left all my other jobs amicably. Well, amicably, as far as I was concerned, it was amicable. I mean, I've had some terrible jobs. I was the caretaker at my own school once. Like Kurt Cobain was a caretaker at a high school. I was quite chuffed with that comparison. I thought that meant that I could be the new Kurt Cobain because I was in a band and I was also a caretaker. And I spent a lot of time as a waiter.
You had the jumper. You had a similar jumper to Kurt Cobain.
It was so depressing what I was doing. I worked at a chip shop for an awful long time, and there's some bits on that DVD of the Ruben DVD of me working at the chip shop. All kinds of shenanigans. Just couldn't get fired. It was like I was trying to get fired from the chip shop one. The one time I did an entire shift on Halloween as a zombie, and I painted myself up like a genuinely terrifying zombie, and everyone thought, oh, that's funny on Halloween, until they got the food served, because I would only walk at zombie pace. And I stuck to it the whole way through, you know, lolloping through people's. And one time, this guy, I just got so cross of things that people would say. There was late at a, I was working as a waiter, and a guy, and I would say, is there anything else you want? And people would say stupid stuff. They'd say, £1 million, please. Or this one guy said, oh, I wouldn't mind a lift to the car park, you know, out to the, through the kitchen door. Right. And I was like, fair enough. And I picked him up. And I took him, I carried him through the restaurant. He was, oh, ho, 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 ho. This like middle-aged guy who just made this joke about how full he was. And I had to use his own body to bump the door open because I couldn't. I carried him to his car. That's how fed up I was of saying, of people saying stupid things when I offered them something else. And then another time someone insisted on a birthday cake. They came and they were like, it's my birthday. And I said, big deal. And they said, I want, give me the birthday meal, please. And I said, well, we don't have a birthday meal. We're a chip shop. And they said, right, well, I have the birthday meal. And they just wouldn't take no for an answer. So what I did was I screwed a light bulb into their garlic bread. I screwed a light bulb into their garlic bread. And then I took a washing up glove and I blew it up like a balloon and I wrote had P Bert Dave on it. And I put that together with the meal. And they were really happy. They were really happy. Another time, people in restaurants are so weird. Another time, someone said, can I have a cappuccino, please? And I said, well, no, you can't. We don't do cappuccino. We only do coffee. She said, right, I'll have a cappuccino. They just don't listen to you. And I said, pay attention to me. We don't do cappuccino. If you want, I can blow some bubbles through it into with it through a straw into your coffee. And she said, yeah, that's fine. So that's what I did.
Wow. I
blew bubbles into her coffee and she yummed it up. It was mad. I could write an entire book on that chip shop and the shenanigans. That's not even the weirdest ones. We got some shit, but there is not enough digital storage on Zencastr for the chip shop stories. We'll do a whole separate thing about the chip shop stories.
Well, maybe we'll have to do a second episode. I mean, yeah. This format, it has no end. We can do what we want.
Of course. Yeah, I had lots of jobs. Yeah.
Jamie, you sound like you'd be excellent fun to have an adventure with.
Wow, yeah, I am.
Good teammate.
I hope so, yeah. I won't leave you behind.
Take it as far as it can go.
Too far sometimes, yeah.
I believe in that.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. I honestly like to keep these about an hour long.
Sure.
Seriously, we're going to have to do another one in the future about more chip shop shenanigans.
No problems.
Excellent. Jamie, thank you so much. Really exciting Sabbath ways of releasing 8 or 9 track albums.
I feel like maybe that.
Me too.
Yeah.
I think it's cool. It doesn't need to be 10 if 9's good, you know?
Whatever, we've reached the point where, you know, especially in the digital age, whatever you want to do, whatever form your music wants to take, it can take. And I think it's very freeing.
Thank you so much, Jamie. Looking forward to the next one.
You're welcome. Cheers, buddy.
Cheers, dude. I've been working all day, bobbing my head on the side, running around like a blue-ass fly. I've been working, yeah, I've been working all day.
This is a Mighty Moon Media podcast.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time. No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.